Ecclesiastes is one of the most fascinating books in the Bible to me. I think probably if there is one book all by itself in the Bible that is needed in our day and that well describes what we need in our age, it is the book of Ecclesiastes. I know some folks that when they do evangelistic classes, when they study with people personally, they always start in Ecclesiastes. And they start in Ecclesiastes because it is very much a book for our culture. Because what Solomon is doing, if you're familiar with the book, as he starts off in chapter 1, is he's trying to figure out what life's about. And when you look around at the United States of America in 2016, that's what's happening. People are chasing money, people are chasing fame, people are chasing pride, people are chasing desire, people are trying to do this, people are trying to do this. People are trying to find something in life that satisfies them. And if you back up to the first chapter, that's exactly the way Solomon starts this particular experiment, if you would. In fact, he starts with the conclusion in verse 2 of chapter 1 when he says, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all of his labor in which he toils under the sun?" And then he begins to summarize where he is going to the point that he makes the real application in verse 14. "I've seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind." And I hear people from time to time talk about the book of Ecclesiastes. I was sitting in a Bible class one time, and I heard someone say, the teacher said, "You know, the book of Ecclesiastes is the cynical, pessimistic, disappointed rantings of an old man whose life has not turned out the way that he wanted." And I thought, that's not what Ecclesiastes is about. And first of all, it's not a cynical old man writing Ecclesiastes. It's God writing Ecclesiastes. And he does offer some pessimism in the book, which is probably part of the reason I'm so partial to it. Because he's looking at life, trying to find out, under the sun, what life is about. And there are some key things to understand when you study Ecclesiastes, and that's one of them. Solomon, at the very outset, establishes this experiment where he's going to figure out what life's all about. And what he says is, I tried to find, in verse 3 of chapter 1, what profit has a man in all of his labor in which he toils under the sun? And I think he's trying to limit the experiment to our physical existence. That's the way I understand the book. And so what he does is he explores all kinds of things that we become fascinated with. He gives himself to joy. He gives himself to pleasure. He gives himself to prosperity. He gives himself to life. He considers death. He thinks about wisdom. He thinks about folly. He considers all these grand things that he has built. He thinks about time. He meditates and mulls over things like chance, injustice, labor, leisure. All of those are elements in the book of Ecclesiastes. And it's hard to study because the thoughts aren't necessarily progressive. He doesn't always go easily from one thing to another. And I find that kind of interesting because I think we are that way. We kind of jump from things to things. And the more you study Ecclesiastes, the more interesting it becomes. And what he's saying is, I've tried all this stuff. Now, as we know, God gave Solomon a measure of wisdom that no man has ever possessed. And he makes this observation: "I kept my wisdom about me as I went through this big experiment to find out under the sun, on the earth, what's really important." We are very familiar with the conclusion we're going to look at. If you want to flip over to chapter 12 and verse 13, at the end of all of this, after pronouncing that everything under the sun is pretty empty, and I must say this, I don't think you have to have the wisdom of Solomon to figure that out. I mean, as you get older, have you not figured out that there's a lot of things in life that don't satisfy you very much? And even the things that you like to do, you're going to be dissatisfied with them and want to do them again. You know, if we found true satisfaction in things, I mean, if I ate the best barbecue brisket I've ever tasted in my life, I'd never want any barbecue brisket again. But I'm not satisfied with one good helping of barbecue brisket. I want it again. And what that teaches me is that, you know, there's no real satisfaction. There's some temporary pleasure there. But the idea that this is what life's about, life's about barbecue, and that's a worthy consideration. But it's not, because it doesn't satisfy me. And something the earlier you younger folks learn this, the better off you'll be. The next new car, the next bigger house, the next level of education, the next step on the rung of business success, it's not going to satisfy you either. It may bring some things with it, but you're going to go through it for a while and you're going to look back and go, I'm really not, this is not getting it for me. And so when he's finished with all that, Solomon's conclusion is, and he states it this way, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For man will bring every work into judgment, including, or God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. Now, here's the irony of that. Solomon starts off by saying, I'm going to offer this experiment, and I'm going to write this down so everybody can learn from it. And my experiment is an under-the-sun experiment. But when he gets to the end, his conclusion involves something or someone that's not under the sun. You notice that? And here's what's interesting about that is, Solomon starts fighting that under the sun, not under the sun battle very early in this experiment. If you look at chapter 3 in verse 14, he offers the conclusion just about the time he really gets going good. When he says, I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, nothing taken from it. Stop right there. Wait a minute. I thought we're looking under the sun. But God's not included under the sun. God's, let's use the terminology, God's over the sun. God's outside the realm of the physical limitations of the experiment. And that's what I find interesting, because Solomon does not get beyond that. And so his last statement here in verse 14 is, nothing can be added to it, nothing taken from it. God does it that men should, what? Fear before him. Well, wait a minute, I thought that's the conclusion you get to in chapter 12. It is, but Solomon gets to that conclusion much, much earlier than chapter 12. If you go over a chapter 2 and chapter 5 and verse 7, he says it again. In the multitude of dreams and many words, there's vanity. But you fear God. Go to chapter 8, look at verses 12 and 13. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, yet surely I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, with those who fear before him. It will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are a shadow, because he does not fear God. In some ways, it had to have been a very frustrating thing for Solomon to try all of these things and try to figure out what in life was worth holding on to, and all the time knowing over here that there is an element outside of mankind's physical existence that demands our attention, and it is, as he draws his conclusion, the really sum total of everything we are. You ever wondered where Solomon got that? Yeah, you know, I think our inclination is to think, well, he was the wisest man of all the earth. And so God gave him this wisdom so he could experience these things. You know, if you and I did what Solomon did, somewhere along the way, we'd probably get lost or discouraged. I'm not sure I'd get lost in the junk as much as I would get frustrated with the injustices. That's part of the big thing in Ecclesiastes. And so we think, well, God gave Solomon all this wisdom so Solomon could go all through this and not be moved by it. I don't believe that's where Solomon got this wisdom that says, fear God. In fact, I would propose to you that Solomon got this from his childhood. If you go back to the book of Deuteronomy, keep your bookmark in Ecclesiastes 12. If you go back to the book of Deuteronomy, something that you notice as you study through this book is that there is a theme that Moses comes back to over and over and over as he's talking to the children of Israel who are about to go into the promised land. And in Deuteronomy chapter 10 and verse 12, the theme is stated very succinctly when God through Moses says, now Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? But to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all of his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes which I command you today for your good. Do you realize that the phrase fear God or fear the Lord in some way or another is used 15 times in the book of Deuteronomy. Now here's what I find even more fascinating. David was the king of Israel, who was Solomon's father. My suspicion is David had a few discussions with Solomon when he was a young man about the things he needed to understand about serving God, one of which was you need to fear God and keep His commandments. But here's even more compelling evidence. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, one of the things God demanded of the king of Israel was that he write for himself a copy of the book of Deuteronomy. Did you ever have to write sentences when you were a kid as punishment? I will not write on my parents' chairs with Sharpie marker. And you have to write that 150 times. And we think, man, 150 times, that's overwhelming. Can you imagine having to sit down and write the entire book of Deuteronomy? Which is what God told the king to do. You write the entire book and then you keep it for yourself. Why did he want to do that? Well, you write something down, you tend to remember it more. And as Solomon is writing down, and his father David had done this before him, all the words of the book of Deuteronomy, you just know that every now and then he goes, okay, fear the Lord your God and keep His... Wait a minute, didn't he just say that back? And you start pulling your parchment and your scrolls and unrolling it all. And, yep, sure enough, he just said this. By the time he's finished writing it, this is ingrained in his mind. And so as he grows up and as he becomes king and as he goes through his experiment, he's trying to talk about life under the sun, but all the time what's been ingrained in his mind is all that I am as a human being revolves around fearing God and keeping His commandments. His conclusion is, this is man's all. That's the modern translation of the New King James. The old King James said something like, this is the whole duty of man. Some versions, this is man, or this is the whole of man. And it's very difficult to translate. And I think part of the reason it's difficult to translate is because it is such a comprehensive statement. I like the translation that says, this is man's all. And I want you to think about that for a moment as we begin. Everything that we are, according to the revelation of God, is to be found in fearing God and keeping His commandments. You think about that for a moment. That is the essence of mankind. Fearing God, keeping His commandments. And I want to ask you a question as we start to go into this. If this is the end-all, be-all of who we are, why don't we talk about it more? You know, if you get up and you preach a sermon about we need to obey God, I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to come back to this point in a few minutes, that's kind of falling out of popularity. People don't want you to talk too much about all the stuff you got to do. We'd rather talk about the grace of God and that we don't have to do anything. And the reality is, the essence of who we are is to fear God and keep His commandments. And this is not a popular series of thoughts in our day and age, but the wisest man who ever lived upon the face of the earth, whose wisdom came from God Himself, who wrote a book by the hand of God Himself, says, this is our all. So let me make a couple of observations to you that I think we need to appreciate from this passage of Scripture. Fear God, keep His commandments. This is our all. We're going to be judged. And the first point that I want to make to you is that fear God means fear God. I don't know about you, because I don't know about your background much, but most of my life I have heard brethren take this statement, and it is a fairly common statement. I already told you it was 15 times in the book of Deuteronomy, and as you read through both Testaments, but especially the Old Testament, this idea of you need to fear God. It's in there just constantly. And what we do with that is we kind of explain it away. All my life, and I love my dad. My dad's a good preacher. I can't tell you that I've heard Dad say it this way, but this was the concept I grew up with. Well, fear God means to have respect for God. You ever heard that? Yes? Yes, I hadn't asked you to do that in two nights. You hadn't forgotten already, okay? Yes? Yeah, no, but we have to reverence God. That's what that means. I mean, I'm going to tell you something, folks. You start looking into this and digging into this, and I think we do ourselves a disservice when we define it that way. The Hebrew word for fear is Yahweh. Not Yahweh, the name of God, Yahweh. And what the word means, and the way that it is used most of the time, is it means to frighten. And very often there is a secondary definition added, if you look in any Hebrew dictionary, and the secondary definition is, morally, it means to revere. It's used as an adjective a lot, especially in the Psalms. And you know the word that's usually translating Yahweh? It's the word awesome. And you see it all the time. We serve an awesome God. We sing this. It's kind of become a popular phrase that we serve an awesome God. And when we think of awe, we think of something that inspires us. But this word means something more like dreadful, to terrify. It's also used in the New Testament. In the New Testament, the Greek word is phobio, or phobeo. I'm not sure exactly the pronunciation. That word sound familiar to you? We use this word. And for us, it's the word phobia. And it has come into the English language as a transliteration. They just took the Greek word, made it an English word, and we use it this way. And we understand what a phobia is, don't we? We think of it as an abnormal fear, but it's not respect, it's fear. And we use it that way. Acrophobia, fear of heights. If you've got acrophobia, you don't crawl up on a ladder or go up on the top of the Empire State Building or go to the edge of the Grand Canyon and look down there and go, I have grand reverence for what I'm seeing here. Do you? If you have agoraphobia, it means you're afraid of wide open spaces. It's interesting. I live in East Texas where it's wooded, but I grew up in Lubbock, where it's wide open. And a lot of times people from the part of the world where I live now, if they come out to this part of the world, and especially go farther west, they're very uncomfortable because they're used to being closed in. And now you can see the sky and you feel very small. And some people, they actually are afraid of that. And it's interesting. Claustrophobia is the fear of tight spaces. Arachnophobia is the fear of spiders. Triskaidekaphobia. It's the fear of the number 13. Doesn't make any sense to me. And I have to tell you this. I'm on my way up here Saturday morning, and I'm talking to Harold Turner. Bill, I think, asked me about Harold. And we talked for a little while, and then we hung up. And then the phone rang again, and Harold said, hey, Russ, do you know what arachobutrophobia is? He said, this popped up on my calendar today, and I thought of you. Arachobutrophobia. Do you know what that is, Russ? And I said, I have no clue what it is, but I'm anxious to know. It is the abnormal fear of peanut butter sticking to the roof of your mouth. Man, where do they come up with this stuff? And who's really scared of that? But here's what I want you to get. People that have those phobias, they're scared of those things. My middle daughter's scared to death of caterpillars. And I mean, if she sees one, she runs. She goes into panic mode. She becomes completely irrational. And we understand that as we use this terminology in our world, but suddenly we want to go to the Bible, and when it says fear God, we want to water that down. And I want to offer a warning to you. We undermine the concept. We invalidate the concept. We disarm the concept. We take God from where He is and bring Him to where we are comfortable by doing that. Because we don't want that God. It's certainly not the God that most of people in our day and age want to portray. And if you have the audacity to suggest a God that you might be afraid of, people go crazy. We want the God is love God. God's not to be feared. I've heard people say this. Man, you shouldn't tell people they should be afraid of God. We shouldn't fear God. You want to know what Satan does that's very effective? He gets us to think about God in ways that are not God. And I want to propose to you, this is one of those areas. And that we need to have a healthy fear of God. Now, I want to prove this to you. I'm not just offering this as my observation about the Word. I want you to run through some passages in the Old Testament with me. In the Old Testament, when God appears to people, people always react the same way. And I'm not going to try to go into, you know, are they really seeing God? Are they seeing a manifestation of God? I had a long discussion with a guy in the Czech Republic a couple of years ago about no man has ever seen God. And I'm just turning to passage after passage. It says God appeared to him. And he said, well, no man's ever seen God. Well, we know no man's ever seen God's face. But God has in some way or another manifested himself several times to different people. And they always react the same way. In Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve are in the garden and they have sinned. They hide themselves from the presence of God. Do you understand the implication of that? The implication of that is they had been in the presence of God regularly, but now they're not in the presence of God, and God goes in the garden, God calls out, where are you? You remember what Adam said? We were naked, we hid ourselves because we were afraid. I don't believe for a minute that Adam meant, Lord, who has just such respect for you, and here we are unclothed. I mean, yesterday you appeared before me unclothed, Adam. It wasn't a problem then. Why are you afraid? Well, they were afraid because they had disobeyed him, and they were afraid. And that makes perfect sense to us. And as you go along, you start seeing this over and over. In Genesis 15 and in Genesis 17, God appears to Abraham. And you know the first thing he tells Abraham when he appears to him, 15:1, 17:3, I am the Lord your God, don't be afraid. Do not fear. Why would he tell him that? You know, when my kids aren't afraid of something, I don't say, don't be afraid. The only time I say that is when they are afraid. And that's what he's telling Abraham. And he does the same thing with Isaac in Genesis 26. He does the same thing with Jacob in Genesis chapter 28. He appears to them, they fall on their face. I think probably involuntarily, they don't back up and say, I think I'm going to bow down before God. I think they are so overwhelmed with fright that they fall on their face. Exodus chapter 3, when Moses sees the burning bush and God begins to speak to him and tells him who he is, Moses is scared. He is afraid. Isaiah chapter 6, Isaiah sees the throne scene of God. You remember his reaction? Woe is me, I am undone, I have seen God. And that is the common reaction that man has to the appearance of God. They're falling on their face, they're hiding themselves. And I would even propose that there are times when God makes that a point that he's after. Turn back in your Bibles again to the book of Exodus. I want to look at a passage in Exodus and a passage in Deuteronomy. In Exodus chapter 19, when the children of Israel get to Mount Sinai, you remember the story? They've been in the wilderness for what, a month and a half, if I remember right, 45 days? And they come to the mountain, and they prepare themselves for this interview with God. And God gives them some regulations about things they are to do and set boundaries around the mountain. And in chapter 19, in verse 17, it says, Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. So here's this great mountain, and around the base of it are 2 or 3 million people with all their families. And they've been following the pillar of cloud. They've been following the pillar of fire. They've been eating manna. They've gotten water from rocks. God has proven to them that He's going to care for them, that He loves them, that He's protecting them, that He's delivering them. And verse 18 says, Mount Sinai was completely in smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. Now, if you just stopped right there, that would be alarming enough to stand there when suddenly the ground is, and you're looking at the mountain, and the mountain is shaking, and there's a lot of it you can't see, but it's not clouds, it's smoke. And then, verse 19, when the blast of the trumpet sounded long and became louder and louder, Moses spoke and God answered him. You get to chapter 20 and God speaks the Ten Commandments. And what a majestic scene that must have been. Verse 18, when he's finished, all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, the mountain smoking. When the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off, and they said to Moses, "You speak with us and we will hear, but let not God speak with us lest we die." And Moses said to the people, now get the irony here, one of the most ironic statements in the entire Bible. Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, and that his fear may be before you." You hear what he's saying? Don't be afraid. God wants you to be afraid. That's what he tells them. And I know that's what he means by that. Stay with me. Go over to the book of Deuteronomy again. And I want you to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 4. When Moses first begins to address the children of Israel as they're about to go into the promised land, he begins to rehearse to them some of the things that have happened to them from the time that they've come out of Egypt. He's preparing them. Remember, these are the kids of the people that came out. Everybody above 20, except for Joshua, Caleb, and Moses, are dead. So these are the kids. Some of them would have remembered some of the plagues and Mount Sinai. Some of them wouldn't have even been born yet. So Moses is rehearsing these things. And in chapter 4 and verse 9, he tells them, "Take heed to yourself. Diligently keep yourself, lest you forget the things your eyes have seen, lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. Teach them to your children and your grandchildren, especially concerning the day you stood before the Lord your God in Horeb, when the Lord said to me, 'Gather the people to me, and I will let them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days they live on the earth, and that they may teach their children.'" God says, "I want you to especially remember what happened there so that they will have not a healthy respect, but a fear of me." Go over to chapter 5. He says it again in chapter 5. And in verse 5, Moses says, "I stood between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord, for you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go up on the mountain." And then start reading with me. I'm going to read about 7 or 8 verses, starting in verse 22. I want you to listen very carefully to this. "These words the Lord spoke." He's just rehearsed the Ten Commandments. "These words the Lord spoke to all your assembly in the mountain from the midst of the fire and the cloud and the thick darkness with a loud voice. He added no more. He wrote them on 2 tablet stones. He gave them to me. So it was when you heard the voice from the midst of the darkness, while the mountain was burning with fire, you came near to me, all the heads of your tribes and your elders, and you said, 'Surely Yahweh our God has shown us His glory and His greatness. We've heard His voice from the midst of the fire. We've seen this day that God speaks with man, yet He still lives. Now therefore, why should we die? For this great fire will consume us if we hear the voice of the Lord our God anymore. We will die. Who is there of all flesh who's heard the voice of the living God speaking from the midst of the fire as we have and have lived? You go near and hear all that the Lord our God may say. Tell us what the Lord our God says to you. We will hear and do it. Then the Lord heard the voice of your words when you spoke to me." Listen. "And the Lord said to me, 'I've heard the voice of the words of this people that they have spoken to you. They are right in all they have spoken. Oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and always keep my commandments.'" Do you hear what Moses is saying? God said He wanted you on that occasion to be afraid of Him. And when you were afraid of Him, He says, they got it. They understood. They got the message. Now, I just wish that they would always remember that. Now, I'm going to tell you, there's a practical reason for this, folks. I'm not just offering these because it's an interesting concept. In the first 6 chapters of Deuteronomy, as Moses is preparing them to go into the promised land, what he says to them over and over in the first 3 chapters is, when you get into this land, you're going to find walled cities. And the people are going to be well armed, but don't be afraid of them. And you're going to find giants there, but don't be afraid of them. And you're going to find a land that your own spies have said, eat you up, but I don't want you to be afraid of that. You're going to run into all these things that are going to overwhelm you. Don't be afraid of them. And then in chapters 4, 5, and 6, he says this over and over. Fear the Lord. Fear the Lord. Won't you be afraid of me? Fear the Lord. You were right in all that you said. Do you understand why he does that? Don't fear them. Fear me. Don't fear them. Fear me. Don't fear them. Fear me. When he gets to the end of Deuteronomy, chapter 30, what God says is, look, I'm going to give you a choice. I'm going to put before you life and good or death and evil. Why would you die? Choose the good and live. Why would you choose the good? Because I have no real reason to be afraid of these people that God won't let harm me, but I have great reason to be afraid of God who can harm me. So I'm going to choose the greater power. Does that make sense to you? And that's the point that he's trying to get across. That if you will look at where the real power is, you won't be afraid of those folks because you'll have a healthy fear of what I can do to you. And this establishes for us a spiritual reality. As so much of the Old Testament is intended to help us appreciate concepts and principles that affect us spiritually, I think this one does as well. God is to be feared. In Luke chapter 12, when Jesus is talking to the apostles and offers some admonitions to them about what's going to happen and what they're going to face and the kind of opposition that they're going to meet and the fact that eventually the truth is all going to be revealed. He says in verse 4 of Luke 12, I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that have no more than they can do. But I will show you whom you should fear. Fear him who after he has killed has the power to cast into hell. Yes, I say fear him. Now this is God speaking to us saying, you better be afraid of the person, of the being that can kill you and cast you into hell, not the person that can just kill you. Now I can't find any way in the world that what Jesus is saying is, that's just an issue of who you respect more. The problem I think that we are seeing in our culture today is a problem that Paul described in Romans chapter 3. People aren't afraid of God anymore. People live like animals. And they live like animals because they're not afraid of the consequences of living like animals. People lie and cheat and steal. People engage themselves in sexual promiscuity. People engage themselves in sexual immorality and perversion. Because they behold the goodness of God, Romans chapter 11 and verse 22, but they don't want to behold the severity of God. And Paul makes that point very clearly at the end of his summary in chapter 3 when he talks about the fact that everybody is guilty and falls short of the glory of God as he quotes these long series of sections from the Old Testament. There's none righteous. This is 3 in verse 10. There's none righteous, no, not one. There's none who understands. There's none who seeks after God. They've all gone out of the way. They've together become unprofitable. There's none who does good, no, not one. Their throat's an open tomb. With their tongues they have practiced deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery in their ways. The way of peace they have not known. And there is no fear of God before their eyes. What God can do to man is a awesome, and I'm using the word the way it's used in the Bible, consideration. And I think part of the problem is as we have ceased studying our Bibles the way that we ought to, we have ceased seeing this aspect of God. Do you appreciate at the flood, God killed every man, woman, and child on the face of the earth, except for Noah, his wife, his three sons, and their wives? God did that. And that's unsettling to a lot of people. There are people that don't want to accept that about God. God told the children of Israel, go in and utterly destroy the Amorites. And at times, he makes it very, very pointy. Kill every man, woman, and child. And I had a study with the guy a couple of years ago, and he said, I just can't accept that God would kill children. But if the Bible's true, that's what he told his people to do. In Genesis 19, he rained fire and brimstone upon Sodom and Gomorrah. And he killed people. In Exodus chapters 3 through 10, he sent plagues upon the entire land of Egypt, and at the culmination of those plagues, he killed the firstborn of every family in Egypt. In the New Testament, Jesus weeps over Jerusalem because he knows what's going to happen to them. Because what's going to happen to them is the same thing that happened to them during the days of Daniel. And that is, God's going to allow a foreign nation to come in and destroy the city. And I'm going to tell you, folks, that they didn't act in some humane way with the United Nations in their little white helmets standing outside making sure they didn't hurt any of the people. According to Josephus, when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70, there was 1.1 million lives destroyed. All of those are God's judgments. And you can't believe in the God of the Bible and not accept that aspect of God's character. And I'm going to tell you, folks, we need to be afraid of what he can do. Now, if that's all we knew, that would be very unsettling. But I want you to go back to Ecclesiastes 12, and I want you to hear where Solomon goes with that. Well, what he says is, fear God and keep His commandments. And this is the second point I would make. And if you're looking at your clock, I understand it's 8:15, we're at the second point. Okay? Chill out. Fear ought to lead to obedience. And that is a principle that we all understand. It is a fundamental element in the concept of compliance. And it is that way biblically. God affirms this. Romans chapter 13... Paul talks about civil government. You familiar with that passage of Scripture? And what he says essentially is God ordained civil government. Civil authority is something that God created. And as children of God, we need to subject ourselves to civil authority. And I recognize we're not going to like, really, no matter how it turns out, come November, but we're still to submit ourselves to civil authority. And the reasoning that God offers here is interesting to me. Verse 3 of Romans 13, he says, rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise for the same. He's God's minister to you for good, but if you do evil, be afraid. In other words, if you have a healthy fear of the government, you're not going to disobey the government. And if you don't disobey the government, you don't have any reason to be afraid of the government. Fear is a motive for compliance. It does the same thing with corporal training. How many times in the book of Proverbs does Solomon say something along these lines? If you spare the rod, and this is our paraphrase, you're going to spoil the child. My favorite one is, do not refrain from using the rod on your child. If you beat him, he will not die. We're uncomfortable with that because Solomon's, you know, condoning abuse. No, he's not. What he's condoning is the kind of punishment where your child learns that if I make their little rear end hurt when they do something wrong when they're little, they're going to figure out that if I do something wrong, something's going to hurt. And the older you get, the worse the hurt becomes. We understand that. It makes good common sense. And that's why Solomon could say in Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 7 that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. What knowledge? All knowledge. When I learn about God and who He is and what He can do, then I learn that I need to be afraid, and suddenly I start appreciating what life's about. There are consequences attached to our actions. Fearing God is the beginning of knowledge. And what makes even more sense is in chapter 3 and verse 7, he says, do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil. I guarantee you there are times in your life when you obey the God, when you obey God just because you don't want to go to hell. And that's what he's saying. If you have a healthy fear of God, you're going to do what is right. And I mentioned a while ago, I was going to come back to this. This has fallen out of popularity. You know, people are uncomfortable if you preach too much about the stuff we ought to be doing. Then we need to be obeying the gospel. That we need to dress modestly. That we need to observe the standards that God has laid before us about local congregational work. That we need to not use instruments of music, mechanical instruments of music in our worship because we don't have authority for it. Here's what God says, and because God says it, I'm going to do it. We're a lot more comfortable talking about mercy. And look at our songs. Get all the new supplements. And I don't have a problem with it, with the songs we sing, per se. Actually, yeah, I have a little problem with some of the songs we sing. For two reasons. One of them is we focus so much on the music that we don't focus on the words. And the whole point of the singing is teaching and admonishing one another. We wouldn't wheel in a piano, but we'll have a song that takes 27 parts and nobody has any idea what anybody else is singing, but that's another sermon. You get the point. But here's the second issue I have. That is that we fail of instructing one another, which is what God wants us to be doing with these songs. And what we instruct one another about most of the time is God is love, God is mercy, praise God. Let's all just praise God. I mean, how many people are writing songs anymore about trust and obey? Or let's get up and strap on the sword of the Spirit and the helmet of salvation. Let's go fight some battles. You know, we don't want that kind of combative mentality. We're afraid it's going to be off-putting to people. Trust and obey is not something that we're proud of. But God demands compliance, folks. We'd rather beg for mercy than do what is right because begging for mercy is easier than doing what is right. But I'm going to tell you, it takes some discipline to get up every day and go do what is right. And if all we're doing is falling down and asking God to forgive us for our sins when we get up every day and know we're going to sin because we're not trying to do what is right, then we have missed the whole concept of trying to come to the image and likeness of our God. And so God says, I want you to fear me and keep my commandments. Jesus says, don't call me Lord, Lord, and expect to enter the kingdom of heaven. It's he who does the will of my Father. Why do you call me Lord and do not what I say? Luke 6. John 14 and verse 15, if you love me, keep my commandments. It reflects a disposition that says, I understand what God can do to me if I'm unfaithful to Him. And I am going to act because of that. But it is a fascinating thing that disposition leads to our good. He says this over and over in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy 6, the passage that says, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God. One Lord, you shall love the Lord your God and teach these things to your children. And at the end of Deuteronomy 6, he says, when your kids come back to you and say, why are we doing all these things? What you're going to say is, God redeemed us. God brought us out of Egypt with a strong hand. And God has given us His law, and it will be for our righteousness and our good always. I'm going to tell you, you serve the Lord, you fear Him, you keep His commandments, you're going to stay out of a lot of junk in this life. But here's what's fascinating. Is this progression of fear that leads me to obey is eventually going to result in love. Now we think of fear and love as being diametrically opposed to one another. I've referred to this several times. If you go back to the Deuteronomy passages, very often when God talks about fearing God and keeping His commandments, He also talks about loving God. It's in Deuteronomy 10 in verse 12. We read it earlier. And you think, well, how is it that works? You know, usually I don't love what I fear. Well, think about it this way. I've mentioned my daughter several times. From the time they were little bitty, we demanded of our children that they obey. We just, Part of it is my personality. I'm not going to tolerate a two-year-old telling me the way it's going to be. And I would, from the time they were little, exert just my physical will on them. And if they didn't do what was right, I'd pick them up, I'd carry them into their bedroom, I'd spank them. I didn't abuse them, but I spanked them. And they didn't like it. And eventually what they figured out was, if I'll do what Dad says, Dad won't spank me. He won't pick me up against my will with me hollering and screaming and fighting him and impose himself on me. In fact, what they come to appreciate is, you know, Dad's not all bad, because when I do stuff that's good, Dad will use the same force to impose himself, and he'll pick me up and he'll go throw me in the front seat of his pickup truck, and we'll drive up to Dairy Queen and get a blizzard. And the dad that spanks me is also a dad that does a lot of good things for me. And as they've gotten older, I hope what they've come to appreciate is all those things that I did as they were younger, I did because I love them, and hopefully they've come to appreciate and love me. And that is exactly what happens with us and God. The very power that created the universe, that can, at a word, according to 2 Peter chapter 3, destroy everything in a moment, is the same power that can save me. And it is that appreciation and love for the power exerted on our behalf that draws us to God. And this is my last observation. Ultimately, it's fear that draws us back to Him. And I find an interesting correlation in the fact that the things that scare us in our world, in our physical world, are very often the things that attract us the most. Is that, do you make sense of that? We have a thunderstorm. I grew up in Lubbock, and not unlike here. You know, nobody in this part of the world ever should be taken by surprise by a thunderstorm, because you can see it coming for hours, especially where I grew up. And we have a thunderstorm roll in, and, you know, the dog's all nervous and cowering in his box, and it's lightning and thundering, and the ground's shaking, and it's raining, and the wind's blowing, and the kids are all scared because the lights have gone out, and they have no idea how to live without electricity. And I've got a lawn chair sitting out in the garage watching the show, because it is the most fascinating thing to me. And we do that with everything. People go stand at the ocean for hours and watch the waves crash in. And you know what they say? Man, look at the power. Look at the majesty. And in fact, we want to get out in it. We want to experience it. We have hurricanes where I live. There are people who have parties in a hurricane. Everybody come over. We're going to watch the hurricane. Now, appreciating a thunderstorm and sitting through the middle of a hurricane, not the same mentality. But it is born out of that same what scares me attracts me. Go to the zoo. You never see a long line to look at the ostriches, do you? Or the flamingos. Everybody wants to see the lions and the tigers. And we're going to get real close, because the things that scare us are the things that attract us. It appeals to us. Grabs us where we live. Moses in Exodus chapter 33, after he, I think legitimately, argues with God about destroying the children of Israel, and God's not going to go to the promised land with him. He said, I'll send my angel, but I'm not going. And Moses argues with him. Basically, Moses says, look, it's your people, not my people. It's an interesting passage. And he has this back and forth. God says, it's your people. And Moses kept saying, no, it's your people. You're the one that saved them. You can't leave me now. And finally, God relents and says, okay, I'll go with you. And I think Moses at that point felt like if he's ever going to have a chance to do this, this was it. So he says, God, would you show me your glory? For 40 years, he's been leading his people around. And he wants to see God. You know, Hebrews says that on that mountain, Moses was shaking with fear too. And yet what he wanted as much as anything else was just to look on the face of God, this awesome, powerful, majestic being that he was serving. Because what scares us attracts us. And I'm going to tell you something, folks. We need that kind of a God. We need a God who is all-powerful. We need a God who is infinite in His existence. We need a God who is limitless in His wisdom. We need a God who is omniscient so that there is nothing outside of His scope of knowledge. We need a God whose power cannot be contained, as Solomon says, simply by building a temple or by anything in this universe. And that God scares me to death, but that's the kind of God that I want to serve. I don't want to serve some impotent, lifeless concept that can do nothing for me. Because all that power and all that majesty that created the universe and spoke it into existence and controlled himself as a man is all being exerted for us. You remember Sunday night when we talked about temptation and that God provides a way of escape? All the power of God's being exerted for us. You read about the resurrection passages and what's going to happen at the last day when Christ comes. We were talking the other day about burial and the expenses and the fact that cremation has become much more popular. And I've heard people ask legitimately this question. Well, what do you... Are you sure cremation's okay? I mean, you know, what's the Lord going to do if there's no body to raise? Well, that's exactly Paul's argument, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. If God can give all these different kinds of bodies to things, then God can take care of making a spiritual body out of a physical body. And I have every conviction that if I'm vaporized in a plane wreck someday at the resurrection, God can take care of that. And you know why God can take care of that? Because He's God. And that power is being exerted for me. I'm going to be the recipient. That's the power that hung on the cross. That's the power that says, I don't have to fear what man can do for me. To me. It is the power that says you don't have to feel guilty about your sins anymore or be afraid about what's going to happen to you when we die. That's the power that gave Himself for me. How can I not fear Him, but how can I not love Him? It is, after all, our all. It is the essence of our being to come to that appreciation of this being who has done everything according to His revelation for our good. And we need Him. That God is our only hope. You know, there are four throne scenes, I think, where the throne of God is portrayed in the Bible. Beginning of Isaiah and the beginning of Ezekiel, they both see God enthroned. And Revelation chapter 4. And the other one actually is in Exodus chapter 20, 22 maybe, when the elders go up and they see an image of God. And all those images are very similar. There is very often an emerald pavement or a sea of glass where they are separated. And off in the distance, there is a throne. And the throne very often is enveloped in a haze or in smoke. But you can see enough to notice that there is a being sitting on a throne. But the brilliance of it all is described as emeralds are described as diamonds, where you can't ever really see the face of the being. You can just see that there is a being on the throne. And in several of them, the throne is surrounded by various and sundry creatures. And it's a fascinating picture. But what's fascinating about it is that we can't see the being. The end of Revelation, one of the most moving things that's there to me is the statement that we're going to look on His face. And I want you to think about this. We're about to sing an invitation song, so you can get your book, get ready, but listen while I say this. We're going to get to see the face of God. I don't think that's symbolic. I think that's literal. The question is, what face are you going to look at? Because God's portrayed in a couple of different ways. Is it going to be the face of God portrayed through the Old Testament prophets where He is crushed by their adultery, where He is outraged by their ungodliness, where He is sending the Assyrians or the Babylonians or the Romans down to destroy those miserable men who destroyed His Son? Because that's the face I don't... You know, I've seen my dad mad. I've seen my friends mad. I really don't want to look on the face of God mad when I'm standing before Him and He's judging me. The other picture is the picture of the father and the prodigal son. You know, when that son comes walking up the road, that man is overwhelmed with joy. He's smiling. He's crying. He is beaming because his son's coming home. And I don't know that it's going to be this way, but I think it's possible that we're going to see one of those two faces. And the choice is ours. What face are you going to see on the throne? Well, it depends. If you fear God and keep His commandments, you will see the face of the Father cheering the return of His children. And there's nothing more in my life that I want to see than that picture. And if you're not ready for that, remember, He's going to bring every work into judgment with every secret thing. You better get yourself ready. So we're going to sing an invitation song. If you need to fix your life so that you're able to stand before God without fear, then I invite you to come while together we stand and sing.